Accessibility Craft Podcast, where we explore the art of creating accessible websites while trying out interesting craft beverages. This podcast is brought to you by the team at Equalize Digital, a WordPress accessibility company and the proud creators of the Accessibility Checker plugin. And now, on to the show.
And it's time to introduce today's speakers, Amber Hines and Steve Jones. You may have seen them here and there, so I'm not going to be doing long introductions. Amber Hines, CEO at Equalize Digital, and Steve Jones, CTO at Equalize Digital. You guys can take it away.
Awesome. Now it's always fun doing this switcheroo with sharing screens and all that.
Yep.
But Steve and I... he might be better than I am. I'll tell you, I'm not super great at watching the chat while I'm speaking. So yeah. We will definitely do Q&A at the end. Paula will come back to do that. There is a Q&A panel where you can post your questions. So I would definitely say if you want to post them, do that for us there. And then we'll answer them at the end. I always forget which button I'm supposed to press. So we're going to talk about remediation or rebuilding and how you determine what the right path is. This is something that people ask us all the time. Basically, we have a lot of accessibility issues on our site. We know that it's not great. Should we fix them or should we start over? We've had people come and ask this that had a website that was 10 years old. We've had people ask that have a website that's like 1 year old, and they're realizing, darn, our dev team did not do what we thought they were going to do. Is it fixable? So that's basically why we decided to do this presentation, because it's a question that I think a lot of people have all the time. And at a high level, we do sort of like a sales or strategy assessment, look at what Accessibility Checker is outputting, just a manual, quick manual audit of the homepage, not a full audit, but just a manual look at what's happening on the homepage, header, footer, navigation menus, and then a dev assessment. And we'll talk about each one of those in greater detail, but that's sort of the high level of things we look at. From a sales standpoint, what we'll consider is things like, how old is the website? If it's brand new, like the person who asked us that had a one-year-old website, obviously, you know, the idea would be, well, can we fix this? Because putting a lot of effort into a new rebuild or budget into that when you've just done it is overwhelming. But if it's really old, then maybe it is time to just rebuild from scratch anyway. And some of the questions that can help you to assess that is, you know, does the aesthetic still represent the brand? Are the colors still right? Is the language still right? Or even just the layout and the design? Does it do what needs to be done to represent where the organization is right now? And then, is the website meeting goals or getting the desired numbers of conversions? And of course, that can be very different depending upon what website it is. On e-commerce, it's easy. Like, are you making enough sales? On a service-based company, it might be about numbers of lead forms submitted, that sort of thing. Is the website moving people where they need to be and eliciting, you know, the number of page views that you want and the number of actions taken on those pages that make sense for the entity? Another one is the website easy for the content team to edit? And Steve will talk more about this when he talks about the dev assessment, but we have gotten into websites where we've found that like the entire homepage or some other pages was completely hard-coded in the theme, or things that maybe they're not hard-coded, but they're using a specific page builder or editing system that the content team doesn't understand. So, you know, that could be an argument potentially for doing a rebuild. Also, we'll ask questions about what changes might be coming in the future that might be added to or edited on the website. Sometimes knowing that there's going to be a huge shift in focus for an organization is an argument to rebuild, but also sometimes that's an argument not to, because sometimes they're like, well, we don't want to do any major work until that's done because our whole team is busy developing this new product or working out, you know, what the organizational shift is going to be for services or that kind of thing, like philosophy kind of stuff that would get in the way of doing a full rebuild. So it is interesting. Like sometimes that's an argument. Yeah, let's do a rebuild right now because we know that we're going to launch all these other products and we want to make sure that they're really showcased in a way that they aren't on the current site. So it makes sense to just rebuild in order to align with those organizational goals. And then sometimes it may be the opposite, right? But really being aware of what's coming in the future. And the future isn't necessarily like 3 months. It could be a year from now. So really asking people to think out ahead, what should we be aware of? And then we'll just generally ask abroad, like, what else do we know about the current tech stack? Of the non-tech people on the team, right? So obviously you still need to have a dev come in and do an assessment, but it's good to just get general ideas. You know, are there a lot of plugins that they have or a lot of custom things, or are there third-party integrations that they have to continue integrating with? Just getting a broader picture from those teams because sometimes they have organizational knowledge that we just don't have. We're coming in to initially assess something. And then we do the accessibility audit. Like I said, sometimes we're doing this as part of a sales process. So our partner, Chris, is sometimes doing some assessment before he sells them on a remediation plan or a rebuild plan. And so this isn't a full accessibility audit with an accessibility specialist. This is more of a, I'm going to call it like a non-technical person looking and doing some basic checks that anyone can do. So what are the scores in accessibility checker? I have on the screen here an example of a report that's got 39.53% pass test, 230 unique errors, 947 color contrast, 388 warnings. And then you can see, you know, there's a lot of issues with color contrast, some empty paragraphs tags, ARIA hidden, broken skip or anchor links, those sorts of things listed out here in the screenshot. And so kind of looking at that score from the automated scan of the whole site, because it's really helpful to have a picture of what the whole site is like, which is why, you know, the bulk scanning is really helpful. And then doing just some basic manual checks like, can I tab to things and is there a focus outline on the homepage? Does the navigation menu open with a keyboard? That's something that you don't have to be an expert to be able to test. You may not know how to fix it, but you can certainly identify that it's not possible to use the navigation with a keyboard even without being a developer. So kind of doing those assessments and looking at it and trying to figure out where are some of these problems coming from? Having a lot of issues isn't necessarily an argument for a full rebuild. And the reason for that is that sometimes when you have a lot of unique issues, it's because the content has a lot of unique issues. And rebuilding might not necessarily resolve that because you might just import in, you know, all those blog posts that have accessibility problems from the past 10 years. So it's not necessarily a quantity. It's more of trying to figure out where do we think they're coming from? Are they global issues or issues in templates versus issues in post content, that sort of thing. And then sometimes we'll then hand off to Steve and say, hey, can you do an assessment on some of these problems and figure out, are they fixable? So I'm going to hand off to Steve right now, and he's going to tell us what he would do when we go to him and we ask that question.
Yeah, so I do have the benefit of some of the initial audit information that comes through and the information from the sales assessment. And there may be like an at a glance. Sometimes before I get to a full dev assessment, there may be an at a glance where I'll just pull it up and kind of give it a quick little audit myself. But then you want to go into a full dev assessment. This is where you have access to the code base. You have access to the WordPress install, and you want to go through it with a fine tooth comb. And here's a few things that you want to be mindful of and looking for. So the theme, is it a custom or a commercial theme? There's pluses and minuses to both. And you want to check both for are they modern or are they a legacy code base? Is it an old theme that is no longer maintained? Is it a custom theme that is coded with custom fields rather than a more modular block approach? So those are some things you want to look at in regards to the theme. The plugins, are they accessible? We've done enough remediations and we've remediated enough plugins at this point that we kind of have a list of plugins that we know are fairly accessible out of the box, and we know which ones are fairly inaccessible out of the box. And you want to assess what plugins those are, and if they're maintained and if they're filterable. So the reason why a maintained plugin is so much better than one that's not is because we've created a lot of relationships with plugin devs, and we want to be able to go back to that plugin dev and request an accessibility fix to the plugin. And if they're receptive to that and they can turn that around quickly, that helps us immensely. And it's also not just a benefit to the current remediation we're doing, but it's a benefit to ongoing remediations that we do later on and the whole WordPress community as a whole. And then finally, are the plugins filterable? So some plugins are built from a standpoint of being extended. Are there proper actions and filters that we can hook into and make any remediation change that we need? And conversely, there are plugins that are pretty closed and hard to modify, and you have to do like an overlay fix or something, and that's not as preferred. So the code is it clean, modular, and easily to maintain? So we're actually pull down the code, and we'll go through it. We'll look at it. Does it have a build process? Was the client able to provide any of that information to us, like how it's set up? Does it have a README that explains how to build the assets on this? A lot of times you could run into situations where a build process has not been followed. There are build scripts inside of this theme, but somebody has modified a built files, such as like a compiled CSS file has been directly modified. And if we were to move forward with this remediation, we would have to reconcile that. So that could be a lot of code debt for us to take on. So you want to really go through that theme or that theme with a fine-tooth comb and ensure that you're able to make the changes that you need to make and that you're able to compile the files without breaking their website or overwriting issues that were generated from a poor dev workflow by a previous developer. And then performance. Does the theme have a heavy use of animations or complex JavaScript components? So, like on the animation side, the reason why this is important is it could be a lot of work for us to remediate if those animations don't respect prefers re reduced motion, and that just adds to the complexity of our remediation and complex JavaScript components. So this could be like, a tab panel. Or even like a kind of a whole little JavaScript-like application inside of a website, or like something as simple as a carousel. Those things a lot of times are very, very hard to re remediate, especially when you need to announce changes, state changes in dynamic components like that. So it's not that it can't be done, but it's something that when you're doing your dev assessment that you need to be mindful of and you need to take note of, because it will extend the remediation timetable out. The editor, is it the block editor? Is it the classic editor? We're to the point now where the block editor is old enough that we have legacy block editor themes, whereas block themes were created initially with you would generate your own CSS to handle the block CSS output. But now we have the theme.json file, right? And you will see a hybrid of the two as well. So if say It's an older block theme that uses styles from the theme and not the theme.json file. And a new block comes out. Like I think Amber stated that there was a website she was working on where she wanted to use the group block. Well, the group block was doesn't have any styles with it because it doesn't utilize the theme.json, so it wasn't fully supported. So you want to be really mindful of things like that. And I think maybe I'd even go a step further to say that depending on the level of compliance that the organization needs, you may even need to consider the back end of the WordPress core back end, and not just the core back end, but like the back ends that the plugins create as well. Because in some situations, the back end of WordPress needs to be accessible as well. So page builders. So this is where things can get really interesting, because not all page builders are created alike. There are some that are much more accessible forward, and there are some that are very inaccessible forward. And you need to be very mindful of if this website is using Elementor or a Divi. And I'm not, those are page builders, right? I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I'm just saying you need to be mindful that if a page builder is being used, you may have more complexity in being able to get to the markup that you need to edit to make things accessible. And I'll tag on to that too, like a major and probably more of a thing to be aware of than even that it's a page builder is that it does it use a lot of page builder add-ons. So like say Elementor add-ons, a lot of those add-ons aren't created by Elementor and don't go through the same kind of level of workflow and accessibility assessment when they're being created. So we've found that the add-ons a lot of times are much more inaccessible than the page builders themselves. So you have to be aware of that. And then
Can I
hosting,
chime in for a second,
yeah,
Steve?
absolutely.
I had a thought as you were talking about both page builders and then like calling back on the animations. And one of the things that comes up with this is that sometimes in a page builder scenario, those things aren't coded in one global space. And I remember once we had a website that was built with Elementor and like all these elements were like flying in a very not accessible way. But it was like just the amount of time to go in and fix the like remove that animation because you had to do it on every layer, which was almost like every section on every page, or sometimes it was like the header and the paragraph and the button like five times in one section, right? And so that's something interesting to consider too with page builders.
This episode of Accessibility Craft is sponsored by Equalize Digital Accessibility Checker, the WordPress plugin that helps you find accessibility problems before you hit publish. Thousands of businesses, nonprofits, universities, and government agencies around the world trust Accessibility Checker to help their teams find, fix, and prevent accessibility problems on an ongoing basis. New to accessibility? Equalize Digital Accessibility Checker is here to teach you every step of the way. Whether you're a content creator or a developer, our detailed documentation guides you through fixing accessibility issues. Never lose track of accessibility again with real-time scans each time you save, powerful reports inside the WordPress dashboard, and a front-end view to help you track down hard-to-find issues. Scan unlimited posts and pages with Accessibility Checker free. Upgrade to Accessibility Checker Pro to scan your website in bulk, whether it has 10 pages or 10,000. Download Accessibility Checker today at equalizedigital.com/accessibility-checker. Use coupon code ACCESSIBILITYCRAFT to save 10% on any plan.
Yeah, totally. And I'll tag on to that too. Like, a lot of times with page builders you could find your CSS and a lot of different places. And for developers, to developers and content creators, like if I'm trying to remediate a page builder, a lot of times I'm searching, where is this style, right? Like I've already inspected it. I see that it's there on the page, right? But where is it? Is it on the component? Or I think Elementor calls them widgets, right? Is it on the widget? Is it in the customizer? Like, is it in the theme? Is it in a plugin? So you can definitely go on a hunt for things like that when using these types of page builders. But
Which
yeah.
adds to remediation time.
Exactly. And I think that's what this is overarching is about, right? A lot of it's about assessing how much time this is going to take us and really is this worth remediating? So to jump back in, hosting, you got to consider the hosting. Like, are there any limitations with staging or their continuous deployments or the Git-based deploys? Is it a Pantheon multi-dev environment? That's going to be much harder, or much more, not harder, but much more rigid of a development workflow than if it's, something you just have FTP access to that you can push up to and things like that. So you have to consider those things. And does it have, is there a deployment? Is there any kind of approval process? Is there a pull request approval process that the client currently has that you have to fit into? So yeah, with that, with workflows, are there strict approval or development processes? So this is probably, this really turns out to be the biggest roadblock that we run into a lot with remediations, even over all the technical things that I just went through, is that if you're remediating a website, a lot of times you're finding a way how your dev team is going to fit into the current workflow the client has. Typically, they have a workflow, and I'm not saying that the workflow is always very good, and they don't always follow modern practices. And you can do what you can from a technical standpoint to help steer them towards a more modern workflow. But a lot of times you have to work within their framework. Unlike if you're building a new website, you're building it from scratch, you're doing it in your workflows, and you have full control. And then there's approval processes, right? Like, when we make a change, it needs to be reviewed, it needs to be approved, and then it can be deployed. And that process can get very lengthy depending on how much time that client has to review those things. Because a lot of times when they go into a remediation, remediating websites is not part of their job. This is a bolt-on to their job because, they need to meet compliance, or they've decided internally that they want to be compliant. So sometimes this is kind of a bolt-on to their current job responsibilities, and it can seem overwhelming. So you have to work with them very closely to try to integrate with them and not disrupt their jobs too much. So I think with that, I'm handing it back to you, Amber, right?
Yeah, you know what I might say? Like, we didn't make a slide for this, but I'm feeling like listening to what you're saying, there almost should have been like a slide that's like client or team assessment.
Yeah, I think we could have a
Right?
whole
Which,
talk on
because this could apply
that.
not just for I'm an agency doing it for clients. This could also apply to I'm an in-house developer and I'm working on my company website and I have to assess this. Because, it's interesting. Like, you talk about what is this approval process, and sometimes people are like, well, I don't have time to, we've had someone sort of recently be like, I need at least 7 days turnaround on anything, right? And so that slows down remediation, but at the same time, it's not necessarily an argument for a rebuild because those people also might not have time to assess, like test an entire new website, right?
Yeah, and
So
I would tag.
sometimes that's an argument for remediation because it's like, here's a small thing you can look at.
And I'll tag on to this, the workflow part that we've found very helpful for us is that I actually will now put together a full workflow document that they can review and approve. Like, this is the full dev workflow on how we're going to remediate, how we're going to approve, and how we're going to launch these changes. And I feel like that's helpful for us, and that's helpful for the client to all be on the same page.
Yeah, so this kind of leads us to when does remediation make sense versus a full rebuild? Where we've landed is there's a few different reasons. If it's minor to moderate issues, then it's definitely always cheaper to remediate if it's mostly small problems that are not super complex to fix. The thing about color contrast that's interesting is it can seem major because sometimes you have to recolor literally everything, but actually that's a really small change because it's CSS fixes versus the entire header menu and every accordion and every tab component and everything that's interactive doesn't function with a keyboard. Okay, that's a lot more complex. So really looking at the complexity of the issues, how hard they would be to fix. Remediation also makes sense when the site is otherwise modern, maintainable, and achieving organizational goals. If they don't think anything needs to be redesigned anyway, then it makes more sense to remediate. And you'll have people that will come to you and say, "Yeah, I really hate our website," or "I can we do this at the same time?" And then they're like, "I want to redesign this entire page," right? And you're thinking, maybe this is when it wouldn't make sense to remediate. Because really, when we're talking remediation, typically the design doesn't change much unless it's an accessibility mandated design change. But otherwise, it's really just changing the underlying structure. So if that site is otherwise meeting goals, then you would probably just keep the design and you would just fix the underlying structure. Budget constraints or challenges with getting approval for a complete rebuild. We have definitely had clients where I thought their website should have been rebuilt. One that we had last year that we worked on, and they are fabulous. I loved them. They were a state-funded entity. Their website, I don't even know. Steve, do you have any guess on how old this website was that was all built with hard-coded stuff? And
At least 10 years, at least 10 years.
yeah, I would guess at least 10 years old, just based upon how the code looked. And at the time, what this website was built with what was a very modern approach to building WordPress websites, which was using advanced custom fields, flexible content areas, because it was built before the so it had to have been built before 2018, because that's when the block editor was released, or right around that time, and the devs still didn't trust it. But it was built before that, and it was really challenging to edit and frustrating. And there were things in that theme that, like, the whole entire footer was not even built with widget areas. That's how old this was. It was probably, yeah, you're right. It was more than 2018. It was probably way older. It was just
15.
hard-coded in the theme. And so that takes what is sometimes a content specialist job, like, change the phone number or change the links to have more meaning, like a remediation kind of thing that normally we'd have a content specialist, not a developer, do, and now suddenly a developer has to do it. Which, if you're paying, different roles, different things, or that kind of thing, like, that might not work for your organization. I thought it should have been rebuilt, but the reality of their budget was they could get approval to remediate accessibility. They could not get approval to build a whole new website. And that's why they had a website that was so old and that was even frustrating for them at times. They had a marketing person who came in and she's like, "I just worked on a Squarespace website recently and it was so easy." And I had to say to her, I was like, "Okay, please don't let this experience reflect on WordPress," because this is not modern WordPress. But that is the thing. Like, sometimes you have to go with where the money is and where the money can be allocated from, particularly with government or nonprofit websites. There may be restrictions, and when they get in trouble with the feds or with their state or any other legal complaint, it is typically very easy for them to get budget for remediation, but it can be very difficult to get budget for a rebuild. And then the other case when remediation makes sense is if they have short-term compliance goals, like, "We really want to be as compliant as possible as quickly. We need really rapid improvement of our website. Like, our entire navigation menu doesn't work. And if I can get that to work tomorrow, it needs to work tomorrow." Those kinds of things. That is when remediation makes sense. Like I mentioned, a lawsuit or a government fine mandated remediation, because with remediation, you are typically going to start getting fixes much sooner than you would ever have an entirely new website designed and built in. So, what does this journey look like if you decide to remediate an existing site? At a high level, it's three different things have to happen. First, there needs to be some sort of accessibility audit and logging of issues. Then the development and the content team has to go in and fix those issues. And then you have to re-audit to confirm that everything was fixed. Now, of course, this might happen multiple times. Things might loop back, like, oh, hey, this isn't quite perfect. Can you go back? And then they work on it some more, and then you retest it again. But those are at high level what happens. The traditional approach to this, and if you go to some of the really large accessibility companies who have been in our space that don't work in WordPress, the traditional approach to this is that they do the audit first, and it's a large audit covering whatever scope or number of pages that they have in scope over many weeks or potentially months. And they log all of the issues, and then they deliver a single large report. And so it's a very waterfall approach where the auditing team does all their work, then they stop. Then the content development, the people who actually can edit the website, do all of their work. And then they are done. And then they say, hey, we're done now. And then they get another audit. Now, sometimes the we did some work and we get a retest, we did some work and we get a retest does get batched out in that way. But the initial audit is always a big chunk of time up front. What we have been doing and what we think works really well is we do what we call rapid remediation. So it's like an audit and fix as you go. So instead of auditing 10 pages first, let's audit the header. Let's fix everything in the header. Let's audit the whole homepage. Let's fix everything in the homepage. Let's write like those sorts of things. Or let's look at what's global and fix those problems so that you can get more fixes, like I was saying, much faster. Now, it's not usually like my whole navigation menu is broken. We fix it tomorrow, right? Because there's some dev overhead on that. But that said, there are two different approaches. And so I would say when you're looking at your website or a client's website and trying to decide, I would encourage you to not say the whole thing has to be audited first and to kind of do this, let's audit, fix, just because you will get better results. And that's more of the spirit of a remediation, I think, and sort of a continuous integration, continuous process. Of course, there are pros and cons to remediation. So even if you think hearing that list that it's the right fit, it may not be. So what are some other things they should consider, Steve?
Yeah, so it's not always a magic bullet decision to go one way or the other to remediate or rebuild. They both have their benefits and their downsides, and these are the benefits and downsides to remediating. You get faster fixes, like Amber just stated. You do it more in a cycle approach, right? You take a batch, you make the changes, you get them approved. You deploy those in an incrementally fashion. That way, you're showing movement and value real quick, and compliance right away, right? Especially if you've been under any legal threat, it definitely moves a lot faster when you're able to do this iterative approach, and a lower upfront cost, obviously. If you're just paying a monthly fee for a remediation, and it's much more easy to get approved, like Amber said, than a large full build that's going to, a lot of times these are governments or higher education organizations that would require it to go out for RFP and then have a lengthy approval process there. So a lot of times it's just easier to get that lower monthly cost approved and signed off on. And then there's minimal disruption. We stated that a lot of times when we do a remediation, we're not going to really modify the overarching structure of the website, right? We're going to go in and we're going to try to surgically fix the inaccessible portions of the website. So the downsides, technical debt. This is always something that I'm very mindful of as a technical person, is that we may need the site may need a future rebuild anyway. In the case of the website that we remediated, that was kind of built with the old ACF fields, right? That was definitely where we were like, this needs rebuilt. But then we're like, well, based on how the budgeting works out on this, we're going to have to push forward with the remediation. And even though there is a lot of technical debt here, and when we got in, we did try to like clean some things up. There were some modules, I think a filterable table or something like that, where we actually did completely pluck that out, and we built our own solution for that. It was built with some dynamic content, so it required some ARIA Live work for announcements and things like that. So, but you want to be mindful that you're not contributing to that technical debt. So that could be a downside that through the remediation that you add to the technical debt. It's not always best, but sometimes it's like a necessary evil that you have to do to be able to remediate. And what that is, patchwork code, right? So inconsistent solutions across the website. So maybe something's fixed in one way on this page or in this module, but then we're not aware of that, or we haven't fully assessed every single module and every block and every page, and we create our own kind of solution over here that's a little different instead of like where you would approach it from like a global approach. Like if this is a problem in many places on the website, let's put one piece of, you don't developers don't like to repeat themselves, and sometimes you end up you could end up doing that when you have to do a remediation, or you have to like a plugin is not maintained, or it's not extendable, or the developer is not receptive to quick turnarounds on accessibility fixes to the plugin, and those have to be resolved sometimes with a JavaScript solution that's kind of overlaid on top of that of the problem, and it fixes it with JavaScript. And while that's okay, the problem can come up is, what if that plugin developer actually does fix that problem at some point in time? And then our solution that we've laid on top of the plugin actually conflicts with what they fixed. So it can be a future problem. And so you want to be very mindful of that as a developer when you're making these implementations, those future collisions don't happen. But there is definitely the potential for that when you push forward with a remediation. And then any hidden complexities, so fixes that break other things on the website. And we see this all the time with development, right? Especially when we're dealing with page builders that have kind of, per page or per widget solutions. And we make a change to like, say, just something as simple as like a text decoration change in the footer. And then we unintentionally like modified something in another page. So that's always a potential and always a thing to really be mindful of and look out for. So when to rebuild? So obviously if a redesign is already planned, and this a lot of times is what we talked about in the sales assessment, and this a lot of times will be brought to the surface during that. So if they're planning to do a rebuild in the near future, it's probably best to hold off on accessibility remediation until that happens, and make accessibility a fundamental part of that rebuild. But sometimes, they're kind of under review, a legal review to be compliant. And they can't even wait that short period of time. But themes and plugins are outdated and unsupported, and I think we've touched on this quite a bit. And if you're not able to work within the plugins, you can't find a replacement, you can't get a developer to remediate the plugin itself, we can't overlay something on top of it. There definitely are situations where the theme and the plugins are just so bad or poor that it's best to rebuild. And of course, again, the themes and plugins lack the filters and overrides. That kind of goes with what I just said. The page builder produces inaccessible or rigid markup. Not all page builders are created the same, which I stated earlier, but some of them actually let you get into the changing the element. Like I can change a div to a nav. I can add attributes. Like I can add ARIA attributes to certain things, but other page builders are very rigid and they won't even give me the ability to add attributes, which really limits our ability to remediate. So that's definitely a case where it's time to think about a rebuild. And the custom theme has poor unmaintained code structure, hard-coded templates. So like that, I want to touch on the hard-coded templates just a little bit. In WordPress, you can create a template and you can hard code the whole thing. Like nothing, it doesn't work in the block editor. There's no custom fields. It's just straight up like hard-coded PHP, HTML, CSS. That becomes very problematic because it's and a lot of times that's like you'll notice that's just one template's that way. And we recently came across a remediation project where it was a block theme, but there was an HTML block added to the theme, and in the HTML block was a full hard-coded theme page, a full hard-coded page template, like
Starting with the style tag.
style tag, JavaScript tag, like all the markup inside of the HTML block. And so of course we have to just delete that and rebuild it in the block editor. And so if your whole theme is that way, then that's definitely like time to really start thinking about a rebuild. And then I'll touch on this again. The editing content is difficult for the theme, and this is something that kind of that gets surfaced in the sales assessment as well. And the reason why this one's probably at the top of the list of when it's time to rebuild is because if the theme's not built in a way that the content editors can build pages that are accessible, you're fighting an uphill battle here. If with every page that's created or post that's written and every block that's used inside those creates an accessible markup and an inaccessible page, you've got a inaccessibility generating tool, and that is definitely when it's time to really think about rebuild. You rebuild it, and then all the tools that the content creators use create accessible code.
Yeah, I mean, I really like if we can, when we remediate, like help make it easier, but sometimes it just doesn't make sense or budgetarily, like you can't do all of that. And so then it really is just like it ought to be rebuilt because
Right.
people should, I don't know. I come from the standpoint of a website owner should be able to edit their own website if they want to. Maybe they don't want to, but if they want to, they should be able to, and it shouldn't feel painful to them.
So the pros and cons of rebuilding. So just like with remediating, there's pros and cons to rebuilding as well. And the benefits here, and this is a huge one, accessibility first. The design and code are built to meet WCAG guidelines from the start. This is the whole shift left thing we always talk about. Start thinking about accessibility when you're designing all the way at the very beginning. And if that's implemented from the start, all the way through the process, you're going to end up with a very accessible product. Sustainable practices. So it's easier to update, scale, and avoid repeating old mistakes. This is what I just talked about. Like if your blocks create inaccessible code, your content creators are going to be creating inaccessible code. With a rebuild, you can build all those blocks and all those custom fields to be accessible out of the gate, and you have the assurance that you're handing off to your client something that they can produce content that is accessible in. And team alignment. So it's clear, a clear modern structure makes training and ongoing QA easier. So when you rebuild, when we used to w rebuild websites, right, we would always end the project with client training. We could go through and we can train them on how the best practices on how to build their post or pages to maintain accessibility moving forward. If we've done the things by shifting left and building accessible blocks and widgets and things like that, then they will be able to use those and maintain accessibility. and then the ongoing QA. So a lot of times when we do remediation, we do the remediation and the clients go into a period of QA where we're just kind of looking at the website over time to see like what they're creating, is it maintaining accessibility and things like that. So that's definitely a lot easier to maintain with a brand new website that is built with accessibility in mind. So what are the downsides of rebuilding a website? So longer development timeline, of course. If you're going to rebuild a website, you got to plan for it, you got to do discovery, you got to design, you got a whole development build phase, and you got a lot of times, you don't rebuild without thinking about the content. So there's a whole content entry or a content cleanup phase as well. So you're definitely your timeline is going to be stretched out if you're under a deadline to be compliant. This can definitely be a hard thing to navigate. Larger teams may be needed. So if you're doing a rebuild, of course you need project managers, designers, content leads, developers, and there's a lot of collaboration that it takes to bring a large website or even a medium website to the market. So, and a higher initial cost, especially true for large complex websites. So a lot of higher education, a lot of government websites are very large content heavy websites. So it's definitely going to be a very high initial cost. It's going to be a bulk cost up front rather than a lower cost spread throughout several months or even years. So those are the pros and cons of rebuilding. Amber?
So one of the things that, Steve touched on a little bit when he was talking about maybe you have to replace a plugin or something, is that it's not always just remediating and doing a little bit of code tweaks and or rebuilding. Sometimes it's more of a mix and match approach. I have a screenshot up here of the Highland Community College website, which is one that we have been rebuilding, remediating for a long time, and we continue to do work on it every month for them. And this is one of those where there's a lot of post types and a lot of things that they couldn't get a budget for a full redesign. So structurally, there's not a lot of redesigning happening. I'll tell you, I don't love the way their header looks visually. You all might also not like the way their header looks visually. But it was like, all right, but let's fix the functionality of the code that's behind it, that kind of stuff. But on the other hand, that we're working within the existing theme, but there were some components or some page templates that were completely rebuilt from scratch during the remediation process. Like the way that people can sort and filter their classes that are available for each semester or their events calendar. They had a hard-coded custom event management tool that it actually, it was very not accessible and it was custom. And so it was like, you know what? Let's just rip this out and let's replace this with the events calendar with some modifications that we made for accessibility. But it's like so much better than having a custom event management platform that doesn't get any updates and has a bunch of code, right? Like we could have remediated, but it made more sense to replace in that instance. So really, you might not be making an all or nothing difference or decision here. You might decide to remediate within the existing theme, but also replace certain plugins, components, or page templates completely. One tool that I came across kind of recently that's neat, I'll give it a nod. We haven't used it yet, but I've been like milling over. And so I thought I'd share this kind of interesting is Theme Switcher Pro, which is a sort of new tool. But what it does is it allows you to have two active themes on the website, and then you could assign. Oh, look, I'm getting balloons.
Balloons. I'm that, celebrating Theme Switcher Pro.
Apparently, I don't know. Zoom. Oh, fun Zoom. But I feel like I should get like an affiliate
Yeah.
something for that now. But anyway, it allows you to have two active themes, and so you could have the main theme that is exists, but you can switch page by page to a new theme. And I was talking to Brad from Web Dev Studios, and they said that they put this out there because they had clients come to them that couldn't really budget for a full rebuild, but could, like we're doing with remediation, could budget for a rebuild over time. And so this is what allowed them to do that. And it's kind of a neat concept. And I've been thinking this really has interesting applications for accessibility remediation. So I think, not that I'm like trying to sell you on a plugin, but I think like there's a lot of interesting tools out there that allow you to kind of mix and match your approach and figure out what works best for the specific website or organization. So for fun, and I think we can throw a link to this in the chat, and we're pretty much at question time, but I did earlier today publish a post on our website that has a quiz that I made, which is sort of fun. So to ask questions like, how old is the site? Does the current design still reflect the organization's brand? All of these things that we've talked about. So if you want to, I would say go here. And it doesn't like you can ask it to email results to you, but you don't have to do that. So it's not like we'd know who you are. But it's kind of a fun tool to just play around with. And I think it might get you thinking about like the questions and things like that if you're working on your organization or for your clients, how you might be able to measure that. So it's kind of fun. And I would say we're pretty much at question time. I'll throw up here before we take questions. We're both on X. I'm Hey Amber Hines, Steve Jones Dev. We're both on LinkedIn, and in our Facebook group too, if you think of something after this meetup. But of course, we're happy to take questions now. And I would love to hear from anyone who has played around with that quiz on if they what they found. And if they agree with the results, you can tell me that because maybe I need to change my weighting on answers.
Yeah, that was a great talk, Amber and Steve. We're gonna go into the Q&A. I did see one question come in, so if anyone else has a few more questions, just pop them in the Q&A box. So to start us off, the potential client's website is made with Joomla. Is there an auto check for this? I'm guessing this is asking for any automatic tool for to check for accessibility.
I don't know about Joomla. I know Drupal tools. Do you know of an automated checker for Joomla, Steve?
I mean, I don't know any like that integrate into it, but like there's definitely you could use Wave to do a per page basis analysis of accessibility. The Wave, I said Wave, there's a browser add-on called Wave that will help you evaluate that, but that's on a single page basis. You're not going to get a full site report.
Yeah, there's a couple of SaaS solutions. One of the most commonly known is Site Improve, which works any on any site. I will tell you it's pricey. Like starting at $50,000 a year, kind of pricey. So that may or may not be a fit for your website or your client. But that will do anything. So I'm sure it would do Joomla. The Drupal tool that I'm aware of is Editorially. From which is a tool created by Princeton University, and it integrates in. Let me see if I can find it. Although it's always a race because Paula's really good at finding links.
Get double links, yeah.
know, but I'm like, who's gonna find it faster? Look, she found it faster. She
Oh, there
always
we
finds
go.
links faster than I do.
One point for Paula.
You were speaking, I was typing. Yeah. So that's the one I'm aware of that integrates into Drupal. I will say we're WordPress folks. We've been WordPress for a long time, but Drupal, especially with this most recent Drupal 8 version, has been doing a lot just for accessibility. It's interesting. And if you've ever thought about exploring other CMSs, it's worth exploring. The biggest thing to be aware of with Drupal is Drupal doesn't always do backwards compatibility. So when you build a website in it, you are setting yourself up for an in, a known end of life. And that's how we've gotten some website, WordPress website builds in the past because they're like, our Drupal site hit end of life and is no longer being supported. And so we're being forced to rebuild our website. So you have to decide if that's something you're okay with.
Yeah, I mean, we've even had some discussions about our accessibility checker WordPress plugin, about porting it to different platforms. But I mean, I will tease that we have had been exploring some options on how to bring accessibility checker to more than just WordPress people. So keep an eye
Yes, it is in works. It's just not today.
Not today.
Yeah, that's great. Another question. This is specifically, I guess, for Equalize Digital. So when taking clients, do you search for WordPress only remediation and turn away others?
Yeah.
So yeah, we don't. It's interesting because our remediation plans are WordPress only. So if somebody needs remediation outside of WordPress, then we won't work with them. Now, our auditing, we audit everything. We've audited lots of websites built with lots of different tools or frameworks, even if they're not in a CMS, and web applications and mobile applications and all kinds of stuff. So if somebody has something else, if it's a more complex application, they usually have a developer. If it is not, and then they only want auditing. If it is something like Shopify, then we will typically refer them to someone we know who works with Shopify. Or we'll say, we can audit it. And then, if you don't have a Shopify developer already, we'll help you find one who can work with our reports and know what to do. So that's kind of the way we've been approaching that. Just for us, it's easier for us to stick to WordPress. But that does mean that if you are a Shopify or a Squarespace person, we're not your competition.
Yeah, totally. I mean, WordPress does, it runs the gamut. There's a lot in WordPress to support, as we just talked about with all the page builders and plugins and stuff. So it's good to be specialized in that area.
One thing I'll say too, I hesitate to recommend ever that if someone comes to you and they have a website built in a different CMS and it has a lot of accessibility, that you force them to do whatever platform you do. Now, it might be right. It might be right that they have, like I was talking about the one that, they were in Drupal and it was end of life. Or even maybe they're in Drupal that's still a supported version. And you're like, you have a lot of problems. It needs to be rebuilt. And here's my case for why WordPress is better. There are cases where it makes sense to move them into what you do. But there are also cases that I've seen. We had a client once, and this was a long time ago, but they came to us for support. They had a WooCommerce website. They had originally been a Shopify store, and they got recommended to a developer. They liked the developer. The developer is like, well, all we do is WordPress. So we're going to build you a WooCommerce store. It'll be great. You'll love it. And they talked them into it. And then they weren't very good at providing support. So they ended up finding us for support, and they had us on like a, I don't know, 10 hour a month dev maintenance contract because their store needed that much support, and for years. And maybe like 2 or 3 years in, they said, it is not you, but we are going to go back to Shopify. And I was like, yeah, I mean, we saw it. We saw the writing on the wall. And so it can be the right choice to get someone to move CMSs into the one that you do. But it can also not be the right choice. And it might be better to remediate in their current CMS instead of trying to fit them into something else. So I would just be really careful about that when you're assessing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Going on to our next question, I'm in the process to rebuild a site and try to figure out a price quote. Any recommendations on how to do it? I know it is complex.
Steve.
Go high. Double, figure out a price and double it. So yeah, I mean, this is a huge question. I think you alluded to it with your saying it's complex. I mean, pricing a website is super hard, and a lot of times we would figure out a price and double it, because we knew it always ends up taking twice as long as we always think it takes. And a lot of times you're at the whim of how the client works as well. Like, what's that relationship with the client going to be like? Is it going to be smooth? Is it going to be difficult? And a lot of times we found that the lower budget projects, a lot of times the clients are a little more hard to work with because a lot of times the money's coming out of their pocket. And with the higher end projects, a lot of times the money is coming from an organization. So it's a little easier to move forward. And but yeah, I mean, I don't have a rubric here, or our COO Chris Hines might have something for you, but and have some good tips. But I don't have great answers for you on how to price it. We'd have to go through it line by line and see what's required and what's needed, how you're building it, like what's your overhead, all kinds of things. How many developers do you have on your team? Is it just you? Like, it's a big question.
Yeah, actually, so Chris definitely, I know he built like really magical at spreadsheets. So he built this spreadsheet that he could like plug in things like how many custom post types, how many custom designs, like all this stuff, and it would output a price that was sort of based on our hourly rate and how much time he thought things took. Paula did share a link in the chat to some information about pricing accessibility, but I would say reach out to him because he might have general thoughts on just pricing rebuilds in general. If you've never done accessibility and this is the first website that you are going to promise accessibility on, I would assume that some things might take you twice as long. Because there may be some plugins in your toolset that you're going to realize you cannot use. And then you either have to spend time finding a different plugin or you have to build something custom instead of using an off-the-box or off-the-shelf solution.
But I would caution too, like a little bit, and I know, like probably in that link that Paula shared. We've had a lot of talk about pricing accessibility and things like that in websites, but I would make website a part of the holistic quote. I wouldn't itemize it out. I wouldn't, because that just gives the client too much of an option to just, no, I can't afford that. Let's just strike that out.
Get rid of
We,
the accessibility. Yeah.
yeah.
So you should have an accessibility built into every line item that you already have. So, like into design, into dev, but don't like tell the client what percent that is.
I mean, for us, we like w when we were doing custom websites still, like for us, we weren't going to build it if it wasn't accessible. Like, I mean, our company is built on top of accessibility. It's our main mission here. And so we never wanted to give them an option to like opt out of the accessibility. So definitely just build it into the whole package.
Yeah, thank you for that. And going on to the next question, a previous nonprofit employer of mine did a big website remediation with a marketing firm. The remediation was not accessible. They decided to use an accessibility overlay as the main translation tool for clients who speak many languages. Is there a better WordPress translation plugin for this?
I didn't even know that accessibility overlays could do translation, so
Yeah,
that's
I
interesting.
didn't either.
I just found out too.
Yeah, I would say definitely use a specific translation plugin. I think the one that we have found that works the best is gTranslate. Is that what it's called? But only in a very specific setup, which is the drop-down setup. If you use like the one where it opens in a modal, like none of the modal or any of the stuff that's in there is accessible. So you need like the plainest version of it possible where it's a drop-down that is in there. But that one is the one that works the best from an accessibility standpoint.
Yeah, I'm curious about the remediation was not accessible. Like the was the I'm curious if the translation was part, only part of the overlay. Was the overlay handling other accessibility issues? I mean, I think there's an overarching answer here. The answer is if anybody says they're going to remediate your website and they are going to implement an overlay, you're immediately going to be in trouble. Like it's it, yeah.
Yeah, I would say if you work in-house somewhere and you're trying to determine the vendor to go with to help you with remediating your website, I would ask them what their approach is, and if they recommend using an overlay, I would not select that vendor. I think what was it like a third of the lawsuits last year were against websites that already had that. I mean, one of our remediations last year was against someone that was using UserWay and or was to remediate a website that was using UserWay, and they had already been sued twice while having UserWay on their website. So that's the thing, you don't necessarily just get sued one time by one person. So they had been sued twice, and the second time they were like, okay, now we need to actually fix this because clearly this overlay is doing nothing for us. So
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We have another question coming up. What about the legal responsibility for the web agency?
I'm going to say right now, neither Steve nor I are attorneys. We cannot give you legal advice. However, we have two really great things that you can go listen to if you want. Look, I got balloons
More
again. It's the
balloons.
numbers. I don't know. I don't know what my Mac is doing. Okay, on our podcast very recently on Accessibility Craft, maybe Paula can find the link for these because she's good at that. Richard Hunt, who is an attorney who specializes in ADA, and he defends businesses that got an ADA lawsuit. So he's coming from that side of thing. He was on the podcast. He also spoke at Meetup last, was it last month, Paula? Or the month before, maybe.
Before, I think it was February.
So the podcast episode is very much of a walk through what happens when you get sued and what do you do. The Meetup talk is more about what the legal implications are. What I can more broadly say, as far as the United States right now, is there's not anything that specifically says, in my understanding, that a web agency is responsible. Ultimately, it's the website owner. But that said, if you don't follow through on your contract, or if you overpromise something and then you don't deliver on it, there have been cases. There was a case in California that was like a $2 million settlement because the agency said they'd deliver something that was accessible and it wasn't. And that was a, and they got in trouble for fraud. Not, it wasn't like an ADA case, it was a fraud case.
Yeah, there was like an RFP involved in all that, right? And
It was a government website.
they had made a hard promise that it was accessible, right? Like, they like promised. So you got to be careful about in your language of your contract on how you speak about accessibility. Not a lawyer again, I'm going to say, but listen to those resources that Paula put links to, and yeah, you got to make sure you're covered. But like I think in the United States, like Amber said, the agency a lot of times is not going to have a lot of recourse unless you're making big claims. But I think there's an overarching thing here too, is if you're selling accessibility, like be a decent human being and make it accessible, right? Then you don't have to worry about it. Like, and even if you acknowledge, like if you're implementing a website for somebody, even if you acknowledge the components inside of that website in your accessible in the client's accessibility statement that aren't fully accessible, then you're going a long way to cover your tracks.
I mean, one thing that Richard did say in that podcast episode was he said that there's this concept which has been around for a long time in the law, which is that professionals are supposed to do things in a workmanlike manner, which basically, and I put quotes around that because that's like the term legally, which basically means you're supposed to deliver your work to what would be considered a good standard for whatever work you're doing. So, like a plumber shouldn't deliver leaky pipes because that's not a good standard for a plumber. And he was drawing a connection with websites and accessibility, that increasingly, especially with a lot of the laws around the world requiring this, that it is now, it is becoming more of a standard that websites should be accessible. So, like 15 years ago, you could get away with being like, yeah, I'm not going to build you a mobile responsive website unless you pay extra. But now, like the standard is it will be mobile responsive. And if it's not, you did not do your job. And what he was saying in that episode was that the standard is becoming pretty clear that if it's not accessible, the developer did not do their job in a workmanlike manner. And so I don't think we're far from there potentially being laws And there was a talk of one in California, which it didn't move out of committee, but that would go against the agencies or the developers of websites and require them, or they would be in trouble. And there is also some repercussions too. If you don't do accessibility, you might lose business, or I mean, we had
Reputation.
people in, a couple years ago that when Chris was doing sales conversations, he would bring up accessibility, and then they would end up working with us, and they would say one of the deciding factors was that you were the only person who told us about this requirement. No one else even mentioned it. So it was a differentiator.
And even then, it sometimes when with the agencies, it comes down to the tools they use as well. It comes down to, for example, like the overlays, they do make those claims that everything is going to be accessible. However, the tools that are more predominant in the sphere of accessibility, they do say you have this passed tests. They do not say your website is 100% accessible. They do say this part is accessible. This test passed the accessibility test. So it does come down to all of the tools that you use and your language and the way you go about it and explain it to your client as well. And then going on to the next question, it's kind of similar about overlays. Speaking of overlays, I've come across several public government supported sites with the little accessibility icon on it that the person clicks to have a panel slide in to adjust viewer's text side contrast. Is this an overlay?
Yeah, so
Yes.
yes, of sorts. Now I will caveat a little bit here that there is kind of two components to like the overlay plugin that they use. There is the overlay factor, and that is like them using AI or JavaScript to try to fix everything in one fell swoop in a generalized m manner on the website, right? Without taking individual consideration for like when I code or my team codes a JavaScript solution to fix a problem on a website, right? We're doing it individually for that particular website for that particular problem. The overlay is taking a generalist approach to fixing it. And even in our accessibility checker plugin, we have some fixes. You can check a box to fix certain things, but then our accessibility checker rescans the page to ensure that our fix actually did what it says it's going to do. Because there may be scenarios where our fix actually doesn't implement correctly on this particular solution. So that way, we want our plugin to still say, hey, even though we said we could fix it, we rescanned it and we actually can't fix it. But so I think that's one part of an overlay, right? Where they're actually actively trying to fix things. And then there's another piece, it's called a widget. Like it's like
The toolbar.
a toolbar, yeah, that has some tools to like make text bigger or to change the color contrast or things like that. And I don't think that the toolbar inherently makes it inaccessible. Or if you see a toolbar that you're like, oh, they're using an overlay, this is bad, right? Like I think a toolbar could be implemented and the website still be accessible. Now, I would say we're at the point in the web that a toolbar is not necessary anymore. There's enough built into the browser. There's enough with CSS and media queries where we can detect if they like dark mode or if they prefer reduced motion, things like that. There's enough there. And then with font sizes these days, using M's to scale fonts. Or rims to scale fonts based on the zoom level of the website. I think there's enough there we can achieve it without a toolbar. I think they're kind of a thing of the past, but I think you could have one and it still be accessible, but it has to be implemented correctly. And I would say just don't do it. Just make sure the website's made to be accessible out of the box.
That's a great answer. And we do have another question. How do you typically find clients as a new player in the industry?
We're old
That one's
players.
hard.
We're old players in the industry.
Yeah, I think, well, I mean, so what's our advice for someone who's new to this that wants to do more accessibility work? So content creation has worked really well for us. which is a combination of we create blog posts or we write blog posts, we have a podcast, right? We have some of that kind of stuff. So SEO has been pretty helpful. Speaking has worked really well for me. And I'm not just talking about going to WordPress meetups. You want to go wherever you think your customers are. So if there's like a restaurant association meetup, restaurants frequently get sued for accessibility in your town, you might contact the organizers and be like, hey, can I come give a free presentation about accessibility to the restaurant association meetup? Because they might not know and they might be interested. So I would say like that kind of general networking, I would definitely reach out to your existing customers, and there are ways to go about communicating to them without making your everyone's always afraid to do this, and I know I was too, like going to them and saying, when we built your website, accessibility was not in scope, or accessibility was not a big thing. This is becoming something that cannot be ignored. I know that there are accessibility problems on your website, so let's talk about what a remediation. These are prime for remediation plans. Maybe they already have a maintenance plan with you where they pay you some amount every month to update their plugins and like big small text changes or something on their website. So you could add on a couple of hours a month to also do re remediation plans over time. And I have a whole meetup that kind of talks about how we do our remediation plans, but you can add these onto your care plans if you have them. And I sometimes will use like pivot points too. So for example, in June is the European Accessibility Act is starting enforcement. If you have any customers that potentially reach into the EU, you should reach out to them now if you haven't already and be like, hey, this law is coming into enforcement and it's going to impact you. And we need to talk about a plan for making your website accessible. And that's not, I think people are afraid because they think their clients sometimes are going to think, well, you built me a crappy website. But really what that's going to do is that's going to tell them you're monitoring laws related to their website and you are trying to offer them the best solution. Like you have their best interest in mind. And so I would recommend like looking at things like that. So.
Thank you for that. And we also have a talk in a few weeks about selling accessibility, where we're going to have a panel. It's going to be on May 9th
Yes.
at 7 p.m. Central. So if anybody's interested, we're going to have a few questions talking about how to sell accessibility, and we're going to have a Q&A portion at the end as well. And coming up to, yeah, go ahead, Amber.
Oh, I was just going to say, and for that one, we intentionally got people in very different ranges. So we have someone who runs a very large company with like 40 employees. We have like a freelancer that has like one or two contractors that sometimes helps her, right? So we have a very broad range of people. So it should hopefully apply to everyone's businesses.
Yeah, that's great. And we have another question coming in. So if you're remediating the site, you can use an overlay until remediation is complete.
We don't.
No, I would
Yeah.
not.
So if the overlay is already there and they come to you, there might maybe be an argument for keeping it. I will say, I saw this once on a website where it was built with Divi. And if you know, like out of the box, the navigation menus don't function with Divi at all. With the overlay there, you could actually use the keyboard to access the navigation menus. Now, they did something really weird, which is that they didn't open down. They actually opened up and shifted the
Oh.
entire website down, which was hilarious. And if it hadn't been for one of our clients, I would have like literally made a video and put it because I thought it was so funny. But I was like, I don't know how to redact all of the things in it, so I didn't. But here's the thing, like it's not the way we would do it. And as you know, web professionals, we all just think, well, that's horrible. But at the same time, it is definitely better than not being able to access it at all, right? So
Yeah.
in a scenario like that, I don't know if the second that client comes to you say turn off the overlay. You might
Yeah.
say keep the overlay until we at least have the navigation menu functioning and then turn off the overlay, right?
I
So
mean,
you might figure out what that is, but I would
yeah.
never have a client come to you that doesn't have an overlay and say, go buy this for 3 months while we fix things. I wouldn't do that.
Yeah. What I might do is maybe go a step further, and if they don't have an accessibility statement, I'd add one and put in the timetable to replace that overlay, and
Yes.
that it's actively going to be replaced, just for the mere fact that depending on the overlay that you use, your client is kind of co-opting the claim that overlay makes. And if that overlay makes a claim that websites using this are 100% accessible, right? Like, and we've seen like the overlay get sued, and we've seen the site owner get sued. You just want to be careful about the claims that the overlay is making. You may be able to cover yourself to some degree by acknowledging in an accessibility statement that you're using it, and then and definitely define the timetable to replacement for that.
Yeah, and thank you for that. I think we're coming up at time. So, Amber, Steve, I'll let you guys the floor so you can have any parting thoughts and let everyone know where to contact you.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I don't know, because we've shifted a little bit from remediate to rebuild. So I don't know if I have big parting magical thoughts. Maybe Steve is better at that. And I'll talk for a minute so he can think of some. But I mean, I guess maybe the biggest thing I would say is just like starting or putting effort in is really important. The accessibility statement, like Steve mentioned, is really helpful. So even if you decide, hey, we're going to rebuild first, I would still put an accessibility statement on that tells people how to contact for help if they can't access some of the content. Give them an alternate means of doing that so that that's available right away. And you know, probably the easiest place to find me is in our Facebook group or on X, and I'm Hey Amber Hines on X.
Yeah. So I think as far as remediate and rebuild, I think it's good to consider that. And I think it's good to consider it from the standpoint of the client more than yourself. Because sometimes the decision on whether to remediate or rebuild will have a financial component, whether plus or minus to you as well. And just like when we talk about overlays and whether or not we should use those, is that in the due diligence, the good due diligence of the client to use those or not use those? You always want to be thinking about the client when it comes to accessibility and setting them up for success. And you know, Amber even stated, even as far as moving platforms, like if somebody comes to you from Drupal, well, I want to move into WordPress because I make WordPress, right? That's a decision for you. A lot of times you have to put you aside in these situations and think about what's best for the client. And if you put the client first in those evaluations on whether or not to remediate or rebuild, I think you're setting them up for su success. And I think in the long run, it will benefit you the most. You can find me at, I'm on X, probably most active, Steve Jones Dev. You can find me equalizeddigital.com, stevejones.blog. And that's about it. I mean, I'm on the Facebook group too, but Amber might have to elbow me to go look at it if you tag me in something. But yep.
Yeah. Oh, I guess other closing thought I would say, please consider on May 15th doing something to help accessibility in WordPress. It could be
Yes.
contributing to WordPress, the project itself, but it doesn't have to be. It could just be doing something for your clients or yourself, and go to that GAD page on our website, equalizeddigital.com/GAD, GAAD 2025, and make a pledge. We would love to like have a really big impact where everybody does a lot for accessibility in one day.
Well, thank you, everyone. And with that, I guess we are done. Thank you for participating. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Accessibility Craft. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe in your podcast app to get notified when future episodes release. You can find Accessibility Craft on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. And if building accessibility awareness is important to you, please consider rating Accessibility Craft 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Accessibility Craft is produced by Equalize Digital and hosted by Amber Hines, Chris Hines, and Steve Jones. Steve Jones composed our theme music. Learn how we help make thousands of WordPress websites more accessible at equalizeddigital.com.